Hi, this is Paul. Welcome to the Things I Didn't Learn in School podcast. For those of you that are newer to these conversations, the podcasts are one of three things that Still Press puts out. There's also a weekly essay that comes out on Substack. You can sign up for either the free or the paid versions on my website, paulpodolsky.com. And there's also a book, Raising a Thief, and another one, Master Minion. And if you enjoy these conversations, I think that you will enjoy the books and the essays as well. And so with that, thanks for listening, and let's get into our conversation. My guest today is Henry Sanderson, author of Volt Rush, former correspondent on metals and mining for the Financial Times, and expert in all things related to metals and electric cars. So Henry, welcome to Things I Didn't Learn in School.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. So before we jump into your book, just step back a little bit. I've got a whole range of listeners. Some of them are real finance nerds, and some of them are much more general interest people just trying to understand how the world works. So who are you, and what's your background? How'd you come to this expertise in metals and mining?
Yeah, so I've been a journalist all of my career. I actually grew up in Hong Kong for quite a bit of my younger years, and I was there for Hong Kong handover in 1997. So that's how I got interested in China. Went to university in the UK and then studied in the US, and then went to Beijing 2007, just before the Olympics. Lived and worked in Beijing for 7 years, covering finance, actually, covering a lot of quite interesting developments in the bond market, finance, while I was in China, and wrote a book with my colleague at Bloomberg about China Development Bank, which really epitomized the sort of state capitalist model of China lending overseas. I came back to London in 2014. I wanted to escape the air pollution, and that's and I got a job covering commodities for the Financial Times, and that's when I got into commodities. Obviously, living in China, you realize it's all about China. But while covering commodities, I then got interested in the materials that we need to make the low carbon transition, and started to really cover battery materials, as well as metals such as copper, aluminium, cover them in depth. And I realized the sort of scale of the challenge. And that's what led me to write this book.
What were your parents doing that brought you to Hong Kong as a kid?
Both my parents are doctors, and my dad went out to work for Chinese University of Hong Kong, and ended up staying longer than he expected.
So it was a totally different era than really to live through that huge shift that you went through.
Yeah, I mean, I really saw the end of colonial Hong Kong, I guess, and the handover to China.
Yeah, and it's changed even more. I haven't been over there since COVID, but we should circle back to China if we have time.
Yeah, sure.
Explain to people, the essence of it is that we're very dependent on fossil fuels. It's kind of the amazing thing that has made us wealthy in a way, if you compare us to lives in the 19th century, but it has the sad consequence, if you increase the population from 1.5 billion, where it was at the beginning of the 20th century, to 8 billion now, and a lot of them either have cars or want to drive cars, you get a warmer planet, which creates a whole series of problems, which we're seeing.
Yes.
And so there's a desire to change that dependency, but doing that shifts your reliance from fossil fuels to a whole bunch of new materials.
Yes.
So is that right? And B, can you just describe the process, like behind the curtain, what makes an electric car go?
That's exactly right. And I like your phrase behind the curtain, because that was really the aim of my book, to say what's actually behind this clean energy transition. Because I think a lot of people think of it as, you know, an image of a solar panel on a hill or wind turbine, but actually there's a whole supply chain behind clean energy. And one of the interesting things is I think we've offshored a lot of that supply chain, so we don't really realize what it involves. And the point of my book was to say, if we want all these EVs, if we want this clean energy, we need to build this supply chain that's currently, you know, really dominated by China. And this is what it involves. It involves a lot of dirty things, right? New mines, new processing, a whole set of things. And I think what I was trying to say is, yeah, as you move from fossil fuels to clean energy, yes, you switch your reliance onto minerals, but that phrase perhaps doesn't do justice to the fact that, you know, even though we have all these minerals, it's a different sort of reliance, right? It's not burning things, right? It's minerals to make things that we can then recycle eventually. So it's a different sort of reliance, and it's nowhere near as bad, for the planet as fossil fuels. So yes, we are switching, but it's a different sort of reliance.
Well, that's interesting. So did you try to actually calculate or have thoughtful people done calculations of, okay, we need, I did some back of the envelope calculations just using some of the figures you had in your book about how much if we had, I think just a very small fraction of the current automobile fleet right now globally is electric. And if you had it be 100%, how much does that represent out of current? I just took copper as an example because I was in Chile when I was doing these calculations, and it was 2.5 times the amount of copper coming out of the ground now. Yeah. And so of course in Chile, this is a very sensitive issue, which is using a lot of water and it's a dry arid place and all these things. And the issues depend a little bit depending on the geography that you're pulling it from. But have there been calculations actually that the cost of doing that relative to what the cost would be of not changing that EV fleet and relying on fossil fuels?
Yeah, I think I don't know of a complete calculation like that, but I think it's much better, right? Because let's face it, fossil fuels is killing the planet, right? And we all see the extreme weather going on at the moment. I think the advantage of the clean energy model is that recycling, I mentioned, and recycling is already taking up a meaningful amount of supply, especially in China. So that's already here and now that we're seeing in China. The other thing is a lot of these processes are improving because they are being used for green energy. So the incentive to clean up the supply chain is really there, where it isn't so much there for consumer electronics or other things that we use. So a lot of people would make calculations based on today's supply chain, but it's really improving, right? So there's improvements all the time going on. And also grids are getting greener as well. So as grids get greener, EVs get greener. And as the supply chain gets greener, the embodied emissions of making these things gets greener. So I haven't seen a total comparison, but I think the path is pretty much set now, right? I don't think anyone is going to go back now from this point. And it's very much a policy driven energy transition at this point now as well, right? We see the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, we see what Europe's doing, we see what China's doing. What's so interesting is governments really taking the reins on this and pushing economies and societies in this direction. So
though not necessarily having done all those calculations. So it's certainly I think we're in a phase of it right now where people are like, okay, we're using too much fossil fuels, we're going to switch to this other thing, but not many people, except maybe perhaps the CEOs of some of the mines doing the hard pencil calculation of how many of these things you're going to have to pull out of the ground. But I hadn't thought about that it's a little bit like all the gold that's ever been mined exists, just sits in vaults. So I hadn't thought about that actually if you create these electric cars, is it true that when it's done, you can basically just rip the whole thing apart and take the copper and take the cobalt and all that and the lithium and reuse it? Or is that not accurate?
No, precisely. I mean, but recycling, if you think about the aluminium can or something like that, there's actually very high recycling rates. If you think of lead acid batteries used in internal combustion cars, there's very high recycling rates. So we can really improve the system. And you're right, once an electric vehicle comes to the end of its life, which can be 15 or 20 years down the line, you can dismantle the battery, you can recycle all the materials in there. Obviously, it takes energy to do that. But you know, people are getting recoveries over 90%. And turning those materials back into new battery materials. So it's very, very possible to move towards a closed loop system. The issue is you need mining, but you need mining to get there, right? You need to first extract all these minerals. And I think this is the point you're making, right? This decade, the demand for copper, et cetera, we will need new mining, right? And then once that increased supply is, eventually by 2040, 2050, we can recycle.
So it's a classic boom bust. So it was a little bit like the China building boom that once you began to move a couple hundred million peasants basically from the countryside to the city, it created a one-time squeeze in the materials.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yes, that's right.
And then once it was built, it was like, okay, we have that capacity. And then then there was a big price crash. And so now a lot of speculators are now looking for another thing. So it's not endless. It's sort of, it's pulling it out of the ground to make this stuff. And then it stops a little bit.
Yeah. And also, I mean, you've got to consider, for something like copper, you've got to consider as China moves from its old industrial model to hopefully a new model, perhaps the traditional commodity intensive sectors will, their demand will decrease, right, as the country shifts. So we may see some easing of demand from those sectors. But I do think price is a wonderful thing. And as prices get high, right, people find new resources or they unlock innovation. And we're seeing that now with sodium ion batteries in China as well. So, we do see often ways to resolve these shortages come up, right?
Right. So that was one of my questions, actually. So if you think about the structure, if I got it right from your book, basically, the big distinguishing features is you got to have a great battery and you got to have a lot of wires.
Yes.
And the wires are mostly copper. And the battery is where particularly the lithium is critical now.
Yes, yes.
And one of my questions with each of those things was, well, what sort of replacements are there for these and how quickly can that shift? And so I understand, and my understanding about this stuff is primitive relative to yours, but with copper, there is some effort to like mix copper and graphite in certain wires, but then in other circuits, it's not possible. And it's important because all of these, the lithium battery is an invention. And the copper application is sort of an industrial revolution type of thing. But you're right that as prices get higher and higher, you get other incentives put in place to try to. So first of all, is that description of how the electric car works accurate? And second of all, describe the innovation that's going on and what could replace things.
Yes, you're right. So it's a copper. You need copper for all types of wiring, right? And I think copper is hard to replace, right? It's a great conductor of electricity. Obviously, I think silver is better, but it's obviously too expensive. So we will need copper. In terms of the lithium ion battery, you've got two sort of types of lithium ion battery in your electric vehicle. You've got LFP, lithium ion phosphate, which just uses lithium and iron and phosphate and graphite in the anode. And then you have NMC batteries, which use nickel, cobalt, manganese, and lithium and graphite in the anode. So you've got these two different types of batteries. The one containing nickel and cobalt is more powerful, so you get a bigger range. So what's really happening at the moment is people are switching to the LFP batteries to remove the need for nickel and cobalt and to lower the price of electric vehicles. So that's already happening, and it's happened in a big way in China. So we see LFP batteries are a dominant chemistry now in China, and they're moving to the West now. Western automakers are starting to use them. And then outside of that, to deal with the lithium issue, you have sodium ion batteries, which are coming already in China. And they replace the lithium with sodium, which is obviously quite abundant. It's essentially table salt. But still, you need to build out a supply chain for sodium ion batteries, and that's starting to happen in China. So there are these different chemistry options, and I guess a lot of it depends on consumer choice, what size cars and how powerful vehicles we're going to want to drive, and a lot of it depends on, obviously, if you want a Tesla Semi, like a truck, electric truck, you might need more powerful batteries, depending on your charging, et cetera, et cetera. So there are all these different chemistry options, but basically the fact remains that at least lithium for the foreseeable future is going to be really high demand because, as I said, you can get rid of the nickel and cobalt, but you're still going to need lithium. Sodium ion is going to take time to scale up. So I think lithium demand is going to be quite robust. So when you look at all these things and copper as well. So when you look at all these things, there are some solutions emerging, but everything takes time to scale up.
Describe, if you would, the geopolitical angle for this. So one of the things that's been a dominant feature of the 20th century, and certainly you can see it in Ukraine right now, is the people that had a lockhold on the fossil fuels have a lot of power. So the Saudis had a lot of power. The Russians had power. The U.S. was an oil exporter. Then it was an oil importer. And then with shale, it became an oil exporter again. And so these flip-flops really had huge significance in terms of who was setting the rules of the international order and who had sway, et cetera. Now this is changing some with electric cars in terms of who has the copper and where the money goes and the political shifts there and the lithium, et cetera. So could you describe sort of what that picture looks like?
Yes, it's a really interesting question and one I spend a lot of time thinking about, which is essentially, China over the last 20 years amassed a lot of control over these clean energy supply chains. Cost is one reason, but also government policy in China and subsidies in China. So the end situation is that...
Also, they're commodity poor, so strategically it would make a lot of sense for them to be independent of the fossil fuel game as much as possible.
Precisely, yes. It aligns with all of China's goals, which is reduce imports of fossil fuels, dominate emerging industries, provide high-quality manufacturing jobs, and eventually sell electric vehicles to the world. But the issue for the West is now you have a solar supply chain that's dominated by China. You have a battery supply chain that's quite dominated by China. And the issue really is the West trying to catch up now to late in the day to a China that has a lot of the supply chain within the country and is very, very cost efficient and competitive. And a lot of this supply chain, as I said, is quite dirty work that the West has sort of forgotten how to do. So to sum it up, the West invented all these things. The solar cell was invented at Bell Labs. Lithium-ion battery was pioneered by ExxonMobil. The West invented all these technologies, but China took them and massively expanded capacity and, reduced the price, but also put a lot of people out of business. So the issue now is for the U.S. especially is the U.S. wants to decarbonize. It needs to decarbonize. But can it rely on China for all these components and materials? And so the U.S. is trying to rectify the situation by pumping lots of money towards this effort to build a supply chain. I think that is the biggest concern geopolitically, that, how comfortable are we relying on China? Because a lot of these applications may have military uses as well, right? If you think about the military needs to decarbonize as well, right? So that's the sort of concern. It's different to oil and gas in that if China stopped exporting solar panels, obviously, the U.S. economy wouldn't crater tomorrow. But I think it's that feeling of being held hostage to China for one of the key industries of the future. So that's the concern. I think one of the sad things is that, as I said, a lot of the technologies were invented in the West, but also the US did try after financial crisis to stimulate more of a clean energy industry in the US. And a lot of startup companies went bankrupt, what they call clean tech 1.0. And Chinese companies actually bought up a lot of these bankrupt companies. So the West is now trying to catch up quite late in the day. But the other thing is the trend toward ally shoring, right? Friend shoring. So not only just trying to build a supply chain in the US, but trying to build one with Australia and friendly countries, Canada and Canada as well. So yeah, that's the trend. I think it's an open question as to, well, what actually is the risk of relying on China? Lithium-ion batteries, solar panels. What actually is the risk? The security risk. I think, sometimes there's more fear than actual. What actually is the risk? And I think we should diversify from China. I think trying now at this moment to completely cut them out is just going to increase the costs for clean energy technologies, and that might delay decarbonization. So there's a balancing act where we need to diversify from China, but at the same time, we don't want to delay this whole transition.
Well, it's also an interesting strategic question from the perspective of Zhong Yanhai, which is if Xi was a little bit more like Deng Xiaoping, you could have a totally different take, which is, hey, listen, we'll make these cheap electric cars like Tesla's great, but that's for rich people.
Yeah.
I forget who the leading. I remember visiting some of them and seeing their electric cars. They look pretty good. I'm spacing on the name. You'd probably know it.
Yeah.
But the leading electric car maker in China, and they make, you know, they make good, cheap electric cars. And if it was more friendly, they could set up like a Japan type of thing. You know, I remember when Hondas came in for Chevy, but the whole thing was, we're not going to try to fight with you. Like, territorial disputes are over. We're going to sell you cars. But she doesn't seem to be thinking or operating that way or prioritizing in that manner, as far as I can tell.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, we've seen recent moves by China to try and restore relations with the West, right? And I think perhaps that comes from a realization that, you know, in many ways, China's benefit...
Minus the spy balloon.
Yes, well, that's the thing, right? But who knows if it's different parts of the system doing different things, right? But,
that's right. It's chaotic.
But the key thing is China, in my mind, has been a huge beneficiary of globalization, right? It's an export-led economy that has benefited not only from exporting to the West, but investments and technology from the West. As I say, they didn't invent the lithium-ion battery in China. They didn't invent the solar cell. They didn't invent a lot of things, right? So they've been huge beneficiaries of globalization. So I think, you know, is it really in their interest to have a decoupling, to have a world that's hostile to their products? I think that's a really good question. And on the flip side, is it in our interest as well? If it increases the cost, if it delays the decarbonization, perhaps there is an argument to be made where, as you say, China could manufacture these cheaper things. And I think we're going to see that in Europe, where European Union has set a target, you know, where all vehicles need to be electric by a certain date. And I think you're going to see more and more Chinese electric vehicles being exported to Europe to meet that target and to meet consumer demand for more affordable electric vehicles. So I think it is going to happen in Europe. And what's going to be interesting to see is at what point is there a policy pushback, right? At what point do policymakers say, hey, there's too many Chinese EVs on the road, right? Or, the Chinese EVs are coming. Because I think probably consumers don't care as much as you might think, right, about buying a Chinese EV. They see it's NIO or XPeng or whatever. Maybe they don't care, right? And that's going to be interesting to see as well. So I think there is an argument to be made for both sides that, hey, why not just let China manufacture some of these things, right?
It basically depends how much one person, Xi, wants Taiwan.
Precisely.
I mean, that's the big thing.
Precisely.
Like, if he's willing to say, basically, let TSMC make the chips and I'll sell the cars, that could be a deal. But it doesn't, it's unknowable.
No,
and B, there isn't much that I've seen in his behavior that suggests that he's prioritizing money over ideology.
You know, a lot of that talk about, you know. Yeah, so I think that is the concern that.
The risk is he's Putin-esque. I mean, they could be making a mint right now and pumping natural gas to Europe. And instead, you know, they've got this huge mess. Top copper production is Chile, Peru, China, Democratic Republic of Congo.
Yeah.
So these are tricky places. Like, the thing that really struck me, you know, I've obviously been to Latin America many times before, but this thing I was really more focusing on the current administration in Chile and others. I mean, there is a big, hard left nationalization strain in these countries. Peru yes. is a complete mess. I mean, yep. they've literally had unstable politics now for a solid 30 years with yep. people. Basically, the political platform of the people who are out of office is we hate anybody that's in office, which is not really – I was literally worried anyways. And then in Chile, you have – in Chile, you know, Boric is the yep. current guy. It's obviously swung left and right there, and you had the nationalization of Codelco back under the Allende. So talk a little bit about how reliable politically these places are, and then specifically I want to hear about your trip to Congo. I've never been there, and it seems like maybe you went there multiple times for the FT, but describe that dynamic. It's much purer copper there, but even a more volatile situation there than in Chile.
Yeah, so I think you're right. That's the political issues are a real concern, and you hit the nail on the head, right, which is Chile is wrestling with you know, how to deal with this God-given bounty that they have of lithium and copper. And I'd be interested to hear your views from your trip, right? But it seems that since Boric came into power, it seems that he's sent out a message saying, we will respect, you know, existing agreements, existing investment. I think he realizes he can't do without all this investment in copper and lithium. And he's talked about creating a national lithium company, but we haven't seen the details yet, maybe next month. But again, I think, you know, I think the issue is that Chile can be a key beneficiary of the energy transition. It's got copper, lithium, it's got great solar, you know, so the question...
Cheap cost of production.
Yeah, so the question is how does it leverage all this? And the problem's been that they haven't come up with a good strategy quickly enough, right? So they've lost ground to Argentina, especially in terms of lithium. There haven't been new projects developed. They've just kind of stalled in terms of what is the strategy. So that's the issue for Chile: how to satisfy everyone, how to make sure the mining is sustainable, that everyone's happy about it. But at the moment, you know, they're doing quite well out of things like lithium because they've set a very high royalty rate that floats with the price. You know, so they're getting a lot of tax benefits right now from this high lithium price. So they need to come up with a concrete strategy, I think, that we need to see how to leverage their lithium resources to attract more investment, but also how to get more lithium projects online. And the interesting thing about Chile and China is, you know, what's interesting about these countries is they don't have a lot of this geopolitical angst about China that you have in the US. They're quite, you know, China buys all their copper. They're quite willing to have China invest in Chile. You know, a Chinese company bought some of the Chilean electricity grid. They have BYD buses in Chile. So they're quite open to Chinese investment. So that's an interesting angle. You're talking about DRC in copper. One story I tell in the book is about Robert Friedland and the discovery of this, you know, amazing copper deposit in the DRC. But one thing to bear in mind is how long it took from, you know, discovery to actually get it into producing mine. And he also teamed up with the Chinese company on this project. So that's also interesting in terms of you know, getting Chinese involved as well.
Just for our listeners who might have started to interrupt, Robert yeah. Friedland was a buddy of Steve Jobs growing up, became yeah. a mining magnate, and was really involved with developing deposits all over the world, but particularly in Congo.
Yes. So we are going to see the future copper supplies coming from more difficult places, such as the DRC. And you mentioned Peru. That's also a concern for copper supply as well. So I do think copper projects are big, they're expensive, they take a long time. I do think it's a real concern, the politics of the countries where the copper is, right? And adding to that, Chile's copper grades are going down, right? So they're producing you know, more waste you know, for the per ton of copper that they produce. So that's a concern.
Right. There's productivity of different. I've seen these. I haven't seen it for copper, but I've seen it for oil before, where you can look at the cost of production of every single one. And Chile's going, even though Chile produces a lot yeah. of the copper, it's going up and up and up. I mean, my take, you were asking about what it was worth, is
yeah.
I was incredibly bearish on their production based on my meetings there. The difference between meeting with a private sector company like SQM versus Codelco is just night and day. And, you know, I started my career in Russia, dealt with a lot of state-owned companies there. Also spent a lot of time in China. I mean, they basically, they kind of work similar ways. And most, China's a little bit different, but they work pretty similar in those places. And I don't think it's good for production.
Yeah.
So my question was, how high would prices have to get before it really begins to make the attractiveness of switching to EV shift for people? And so there's a lot of, I know in the financial markets and the people who focus on it, there's, you know, there's certain people who are saying that, you know, copper prices can really explode. And this isn't investment advice or something. I'm just sort of distilling what they're saying. And that because the oil companies are looking at this shift and they're basically underinvesting, that the slip to EV is not, the shift to EV is not yet realistic because of these supply constraints. And then you could also get more desire to, you get more, a slower drop off of the demand for fossil fuels than people were expected with limited production. So you get basically the worst of both worlds. That's a certain scenario.
Yes, that's an interesting interesting scenario. I do think there is a risk that, as you say, like inflationary pressures build and build, right? And that's what we saw last year, which battery costs starting to go up because of raw material prices, et cetera. So that is a concern. What we're seeing, which is interesting, is automakers actually investing in mining companies to try and bring more supply online, especially in lithium. We saw GM agreeing to invest in a lithium project in Nevada to really push the project over the line, to give the funding it needs to bring new supply on, because they don't want to be threatened by, as you say, higher prices, you know, increasing their costs.
How did you find in Chile, in part because of the changes there, it's the thing I wrote about in the post, the security situation there has deteriorated markedly, particularly the northern part of the country for issues having to do with regional instability in Bolivia and also Venezuela. What was it like? What was it like traveling around? What's it like traveling around Congo these days? Like, can you get in and out normally or doing your research?
Yeah, so... No, it's fine to go there. I went there before COVID, but my colleagues just went there last month. And the area where the cobalt and copper mining is in the southeast, so it's kind of relatively stable and secure, easy to get to. You go to Lubumbashi, which is the big city there, and then you can either fly or drive to Kolwezi, which is the town where all the mining projects are. And what's so interesting about the DRC is you have these big mining companies there with big mines, which are behind, you know, fenced off areas, or they're sort of like big industrial facilities. And then you have the artisanal or the local people mining by hand and taking these cobalt and copper to little depots, often run by Chinese, and they weigh the rocks, and they buy the metal because it's so rich in metal, and it's quite close to the surface, so people can dig cobalt and copper up relatively easily. So it's definitely an accessible area, and I think one thing we need to see is more engagement with the DRC, more transparency, and more willingness by automakers to engage with the reality of the place. And I think the risk is that efforts are being made to improve the artisanal mining situation, to create mines that are fenced in and given some safety equipment, but because it's not perfect, automakers are reluctant to buy the cobalt and copper from these places. So that's a concern, right? They don't want any risk of accidents or child labor, but by doing that you don't get the improvements perhaps. So we need to support improvements on what's going on in the ground.
And it could be transformational for some of these countries, because they, the same way the oil age was transformational for Abu Dhabi and Dubai and all these types of places, Kuwait and stuff like that, it was a real, Zambia also is a significant exporter. So this would be a wealth transfer, if you weigh if you will, away from the Russias and the Saudis of the world towards a different group of people. And so if you're talking about, you know, more equitable type of thing, but then you'd have to tolerate, what is the, I haven't been tracking that closely, so what is the political situation right now in Congo and Zambia?
DRC at the moment, we see a lot more Western interest in the DRC, especially from the US, to try and reinvigorate the partnership between the US and the DRC, and to perhaps, you know, reduce the country's reliance on China. And the DRC government as well is trying to look at some of the contracts that were signed under Joseph Kabila, the previous president, with a lot of these Chinese companies. And actually the biggest Chinese mining company in the country and the second biggest cobalt producer in the world is locked in a dispute at the moment over its mine. And it actually can't export from the country, as far as I know, the latest information. So both the DRC government is trying to relook at some of these Chinese deals, and the US government is trying to increase its presence there. But I think it could be a huge opportunity for the country because they have hydropower, they have a young population, they also have lithium in the DRC as well. But the issue for them is, you know, can they move up the value chain? You need, you know, to build more industrial facilities, you need, you know, reagents, you need, you know, better logistics, you need all these things, you need skilled people. So it's quite difficult. But you're right about other countries benefiting. If you look at Indonesia, that's benefited hugely from its nickel resources, and they've really leveraged that into attracting a lot of investment in processing in Indonesia. So you're right, there are all these countries that I think are going to be key to clean energy transition. I think of them as Indonesia, Australia, Chile, Argentina, you know, Canada, you know, China, obviously.
But there's a big difference in the political stability. I mean, in other words, if I, as an investor, and you just look at the discounting on the companies there in Australia or Canada versus Democratic Republic of Congo or Chile or something, like, I looked at this company in, which you mentioned some in the book, SQM, which is the private sector company, which has a complicated tie-in to how it was created under Pinochet or something like that.
Yes.
But it's a profitable, capable company. But then there's a real question of, are they going to be, is their concession going to be extended? Are they going to create with a public sector alternative?
Precisely.
And so as an investor in these companies, it can be extremely risky.
And I think that's an interesting point you bring up. For Chile, you're right. SQM faces, you know, having their, you know, their lease expires in 2030. So the issue is that they, you know, if they want to invest more to make it more sustainable, to extract lithium, to build desalination, to do all these things, they perhaps need some greater certainty or timeline, right? Especially to show their investors, in order to invest the big money needed to improve the operation. So that's an example where, as you say, we need political certainty to make the investments to decarbonize the supply chain, right? So that is a concern, I think, for companies, I guess.
What's the political situation in Congo right now? I mean, the civil war, that it was, you know, massive corruption when the stuff was getting built, but what's the state? I haven't looked on, I had the head of Transparency International here on the show before.
Okay.
Let me just Google what the Congo Transparency International, how it does.
Yes.
Score.
You know, so you know, they have an issue in the Northeast, obviously, that's been going on a while, but I'm not a DRC expert, so I can't speak on the latest situation, unfortunately.
166 out of 180. So that's pretty bad. That's more corrupt than Russia, which is saying something.
Yeah. I don't know the latest political ins and outs, but you know, certainly the mining area, you know, we haven't seen any disruptions apart from, as I say, this dispute with the Chinese company and the DRC.
Okay, fair enough. Anything else, big picture, that we've missed on the general story?
So I think one thing I didn't include in the book, because it happened after the book, is just the huge effort by the US to. You know, it's very interesting. It's an example of geopolitical competition really helping the climate, you know, dealing with climate change, where the US is investing you know, billions in building a clean energy supply chain through the Inflation Reduction Act, these other policies. But, you know, it's just fascinating to see how it's all going to work out, because they're throwing lots of money at it. But what's going to happen to costs? What's going to be the impact on other countries, right? If the US is subsidizing to such an extent, if Europe is subsidizing to such an extent, you know, do we see costs eventually go up because you know, we're negating some of the benefits of global supply chains? And so that I think is really interesting development.
What's the biggest? I haven't looked at the nitty gritty of the Inflation Reduction Act. What's the biggest subsidies that they're offering?
Well, I think they have a production tax credit. So, you know, this is really quite generous. If you want to manufacture batteries in the US, you get a tax credit up to, you know, so $35 a kilowatt hour to make battery cells. So if you think of battery cells being $120 a kilowatt hour, you know, it's quite a generous production tax credit. So I think that's really quite transformational. You know, that's very generous. And that's why we're seeing a real boom in investment in the US at the moment.
The podcast is called Things I Didn't Learn in School, and we've had all sorts of people give me their biggest lessons, and they've all been different. So for you, either in terms of professionally, your evolution from, you know, seeing this whole trajectory or the book, what are the sort of the biggest things that you've learned?
So I think the biggest thing I, you know, perhaps didn't learn in school is the importance of people. And if you think of a future where AI is going to come more and more prominent, you know, and I think about this when I think about my children, which is the importance of people skills. And I think this is something that schools can do more to teach or to stress, which is, you know, great people skills are just such a good skill, right? And it, as you know, in any office you work in, you know, people who are good with people do well, right? And it's an important skill in a future where AI will do a lot, but it can't necessarily be great at, you know, social interaction.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Really enjoyed our conversation.
It's great. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. We're genuinely touched by all the support. If you want to see more of this type of content, sign up to my Substack on paulpodolsky.com and become a paid subscriber. That helps support the team. You could also submit a review to Apple Podcasts, which draws other listeners to this. If you have any questions, you can email me, paul@paulpodolsky.com, and follow me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Thanks so much.
Today's podcast was produced and edited by Dave Manahan.